Well, good morning. My name is Ryan Wampler. If you don't know me, I'm one of the pastors that works with small groups here at The Crossing. This week tends to be a big vacation week since the 4th of July celebration was this past week. In that vein, somewhat spurred on the Hamilton soundtrack myself, I've been diving into some books about the American Revolution. And one of the groups of people that has interested me, that at least I have had a tendency to overlook, have been those that were living in the American colonies that remained loyal to the British crown and didn't join the revolution. Some historians suggest that anywhere upwards of one-fifth to one-third of American colonists sided with the British during the American Revolution. Who were these people? And why did they decide to be loyalists rather than revolutionaries? Well, some were large landowners, or certain kinds of businessmen, or even Church of England ministers that benefited by having England in control rather than the revolutionaries being in control. And so they wanted to keep things in the status quo. Some even have had bad experiences with rebels and distrusted them as an unruly mob. And we know how it all played out, and so it's easy to assume, but why would you have ever bet on a much smaller, underarmed, underfunded, undertrained army to beat the Midas military in the world? See, why would you bet on the rebels during the American Revolution? One gentleman, Beverly Robinson, and that's right, somebody named their son Beverly. He was a childhood friend of George Washington, and he was a significant landowner in New York, and therefore he had a lot of interest in Britain staying in control and power. And so for 2 years, he just tried to delay because he had friendships, but he also had business interests on both sides. And so he tried to delay. And then John Jay finally said to him, all right, you either need to take a vow of allegiance to the American Revolution or you need to go over to the other side. And so finally pushed into position, he did. And he put his chips down with the British Empire and allied with them. And that was, however it went down, he was risking his business, his home, his own life, perhaps his family's life, were at risk, and who was going to win this war? And ironically, when George Washington was directing the war in New York, he was doing so from Robinson's house, which had been requisitioned by the American rebels, and Washington had even dined there before with his childhood friend, even before taking it over. And so, obviously, Robinson lost his home, and he lost much else besides that. A lot of loyalists had to flee the country during or after the revolution. They had to go to places like Canada, Jamaica, the Bahamas, Australia. Some even went back to England. Many of them lost their wealth. A lot of them also lost their health by traveling to all these different places. Some lost even family members to diseases. And all of this was the risk of not rallying to join the revolution, but instead keeping the status quo. And the 21st century has had quite the revolutionary start. There's been revolutions all over the world in these last 18 years. Ukraine, Egypt, Turkey, Syria, just to name a few out of the many more that have occurred. And in some of these places, the revolutions won out. In some place, the rebellions were squashed. And so what you pick really matters. And it's revolutions that have a tendency to bring out a decisiveness when it comes to where your loyalties lie. See, Jesus wasn't interested in taking military or political power during his time on earth, but he was very interested in where our loyalties lied. He very much wanted us to draw our loyalty towards him, and in that way, he was a revolutionary of sorts. And all kinds of people rallied to him then and still rally to him today. But that's not to say that that's an easy or simple thing to do. And so as we continue our series through the extraordinary nobodies of the Bible, we've come to an unusual group of people who are referred to as David's mighty men. Now, they are listed twice in the Old Testament. One is in 2 Samuel 23, and the other one is in 1 Chronicles 11. And it's a group of men who joined David and remained loyal to him. And they were noteworthy because of their heroic deeds and military service towards David. And it was because of these men, largely, that David's kingdom was established. That's even how they are introduced in 1 Chronicles 11. This is what it says at the beginning of the list of men. Now, these are the chiefs of David's mighty men, who gave him strong support in his kingdom together with all of Israel to make him king according to the word of the Lord concerning Israel. So they were crucial in the role of David becoming king in Israel. And both lists break down the mighty men into a group of three and another group of 30. And that's the title for each of them, the three and the 30. And the three were described in particularly because of their heroic acts that they did. For example, one guy killed hundreds of Philistines with a spear. The other two are mentioned because they stood still in a battle when the rest of Israel fled, and they helped lead Israel to victory in those battles against the Philistines. And then the other group is roughly 30 people, but there's more than 30 people in each list. And as a matter of fact, 1 Chronicles adds 16 more people than the list in 2 Samuel. So the 30 is either just a term, hey, the 30, or it is that people died and were replaced by other people, and it was more like an office, and it became that way. And so these people, particularly when it's listed out the 30, they don't have many heroic acts described. Most are listed just by their name and their family or the place they come from. So, for example, one is Sibbekai the Hushathite, and then it's Abiel the Arbathite, you know. And so who are these people? What are their stories? Wouldn't that be interesting to know? So much is just left to our imagination. But here's why I'm talking about this morning, because this list of what seems to us to be random names of forgotten families from forgotten places is a list that's still being read and recounted today, all because they rallied to David and the kingdom that God was building through him. And that's why I think this list is an encouragement to us this morning, because that is why, you know, will our names be mentioned as people who rallied to Christ as our king to help build his kingdom that God was building through him? And so, like I said, a lot about these mighty men is left to our imagination. And there are some things, though, that we do learn about them from the text. And the first thing that we learn is that they went to great risks in rallying to David. It was risky to rally to David because in the beginning, he wasn't even the king of Israel. Another man, Saul, was king, and he wasn't a good king. He was, however, the king that the people had asked for, a king like the other nations, and it was the king that God gave them. But God, in his mercy, also gave them a king that they didn't deserve and that they didn't ask for, a good man who is described as a man after God's own heart, David. But even though David's been anointed king, the problem is that there's someone else on the throne and he's alive, and that's Saul. Okay, so David, because God put him there, David can't assassinate him or rebel against him. And so David serves Saul to try to work for the good of Saul's kingdom. But on the other side, he's left to wait until the time that God sees fit to establish him as king. But the problem is this, that Saul knows that David has been anointed to be king and is envious and jealous of David. And Saul finally decides that David needs to be taken out as a threat, even though that David has done him no wrong. And so David has to go on the run. He's an outlaw. He's on the run, and he is hiding in a cave, and it's while he's hiding in this cave on the run from Saul that men begin to rally to him and join the revolution that he is starting. And so he's hiding in the cave, and it's a risk, because to side with David is to risk being labeled a traitor. It's a risk of your land and your property. It's a risk of your life and possibly even the life of your family members. Revolutions are always risky, even today. And that's why there is a risk in rallying to Christ. What if it doesn't turn out to be true? What if I damage my relationships with my friends or family members? What if I look like a fool or a small-minded person, or even a bigot towards coworkers. See, the reality is that it's easy to just like the status quo because all change is risk. And if we really walk away from our own agenda for our lives to follow Christ, well, that means that we are surrendering the ultimate authority and control in our life. And that can be scary. And so we find all kinds of ways to lessen the risk. We say things like religion is something you can take too seriously. Now, religion is easily abused. You know, that kind of phrase and that kind of thinking. There's all kinds of crazy things that are done in the name of religion. But that can also be a phrase that we can use to justify for a half-hearted devotion, right? Sometimes we settle for being church attenders who can find Christianity to Sunday mornings, but not what we do during the week. We reduce Christianity to having voted for Jesus at one point in our lives. You know, and we feel good about ourselves. I voted for Jesus once, you know, just like someone might feel good about themselves for having voted for a Green Party candidate at some point in their life. And they say, I'm an environmentalist. I voted for a Green Party. Even though they're living the same environmental impact as everybody else around them, but they can feel good about themselves because they voted for the Green Party once. Or we can pick and choose verses of the Bible to confirm what we want to hear rather than allowing the Bible to correct or challenge us in ways that make us uncomfortable in order that we could more closely follow Jesus. Now, I feel like I need to say a couple things here, in that, one, it's not wrong to take time to think it through and ask questions. Some of you might be here for the very first time, and hear me say this, to seriously consider Christianity, sometimes we need to stick our toes in the water or walk a bit of the way in. You have to attend church for a while without fully knowing what you think. You know, you have to go to classes like we offer here at The Crossing, like Christianity Explored or the Discovery class, with the willingness to think it through and ask questions and decide what you believe. And that's okay. I'm not trying to pressure you in this process. But it is also important for us to know that the decision to be a Christian means eventually we have to go all in. We have to go all the way out. You know, it's okay for Jesus to be a guest in our house, but eventually we need to ask him to live there. And even then, we still go through this process of letting him reorder the various rooms of our house. And there's some rooms that we keep closed that we don't want Jesus to touch, or there's places that we take back from him. And so we are all in process of offering up our lives more and more to Jesus. And so what might be holding us back from rallying more fully to Jesus? What risks feel too steep for going all in? What area of life are we scared to allow Jesus to enter into? See, these are the questions we need to ask ourselves, but as we already saw, these mighty men in David's time were willing to take that risk and go out to David even though he was hiding in a cave. They were willing to risk their lives, their homes, their property. And another thing that we learn about these men that helps us to understand why they took that risk is that these were men who knew they had little to lose. Some of the men on the list aren't surprising. They're men from the villages in Judah, and that's David's tribe, so it's not a surprise. But many others were from nearby Benjamin, which is a little more surprising because that's where Saul, the current king, is from. One was even from Saul's hometown of Gibeah. Wouldn't that be an interesting story to know? You know, of why he joined David, even though he grew up in Saul's hometown. And so, you know, some were from other tribes like Reuben or Gad. But even more shocking is that there were several foreigners listed who were from nearby countries who rallied to join the king of Israel. What motivates someone from another country that's at war with Israel to come and you join an upstart Israelite king who was not even king yet? We have Zelek the Ammonite, Ithma the Moabite, Uriah the Hittite, to whom we'll come back later. And we see a little bit of the motivation come through when we see a description in 1 Samuel 22, 1-2 of the men that came to David. It says this, David departed from there and escaped to the cave of Adullam. And when his brothers and all his father's house heard it, they went down there to him. And everyone who was in distress, and everyone who was in debt, and everyone who was bitter in soul gathered to him, and he became commander over them, and there were with him about 400 men. So debtors, people in distress, people bitter in soul, foreigners. This is the ragtag assortment of people who rallied to David at a cave in the wilderness. See, the mighty men were leaders among this large group of some 400 men that came, and even more were added to that number later. But why this group? Why did this group rally to David at this point in his life? Well, they knew they had little to lose. They had debts. They were already outsiders, outcasts. And so they knew they had little to lose with Saul being king of the land, so they were willing to risk it to go to David. And even today, the people who are most willing to let Jesus take control are those who've already made a mess of their life. Those who can't find their place in the world. Those who've come up against a problem that they can't solve in their own power. These are the ones who know that they don't have much to lose. Why not risk it to follow Jesus? But here's the reality. Here's the reality, though. Everyone has little to lose. Everyone does. Because if what Jesus says is true, and that he promises and offers to everyone eternal goodness and blessing, then what does it matter whether we're trading $5 or $5 million in for that? $5 and $5 million both have an end, and both are small when you compare it to everlasting goodness and blessing. See, but that's the problem, isn't it? That's the problem with wealth and riches and fame and attention, is that it blinds us, it numbs us. Of being an insider, of being a somebody. See, it's not that any of those things are wrong in and of themselves, but all these things can numb us to the reality that we're really nobodies without Christ. And that's why Jesus even said that it was easier for a camel to enter in through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to enter into the kingdom of heaven. It's because those things numb us to seeing our true condition. Success, our little tastes of celebrity that we get here in Columbia, Missouri. Money, they all numb us to the drive and the need to look for something better. None of those things fully satisfy us in this life, and they never satisfy that ache we have for something more, but they keep us hooked to keep trying to find something in this life to fill us. See, all these little successes are like the little win we get on the slot machine that keep us putting money in order to get to the jackpot, right? Where every token we put in and every pull of the lever, we're actually just sitting in the seat that if we sit there long enough will lead us to financial ruin. And that's what success and fame can be to us. And since we live in a day and age with so much stuff, we all just need to take a step back and ask, is this what I really want to be living for? See, life can be so busy that it begins to take the steering wheel from us. And sometimes we need to let ourselves feel discontent with our life. We need to remind ourselves sometimes that it's not just another vacation that's going to make me happy. It's not another job promotion that will finally be it. We need to create space and have conversations, read passages of the Bible, come to worship services that stir up a rightful discontentment with the status quo. Not a discontentment that just looks to another adventure or other stuff, and not ones that pile us under despair and depression, but ones that drive us to live for Jesus' kingdom now and to wait for the fullness of that kingdom to come, which is the only place where we're truly going to be satisfied. That's the kind of discontentment that we all need, that nothing in this world is going to make me happy except for living for Jesus' kingdom and waiting for it to come in its fullness. That's what the men who went out to David knew. That they are risking something very little. There's no gain for them with Saul as king. Their only hope was David to be king. And that was a long process for them of laboring and fighting and waiting until the time that David finally became king. And that's what we have to go through as well. And even though they knew they had little to risk, they also knew, though, the goodness of David. Saul, on the other hand, as king, was jealous and envious. He hoarded resources and wanted people to serve him for his benefit at their cost. That's what Saul, the kind of king that Saul was. And amidst this list of mighty men, the author pauses to tell a story about David and the mighty men, but with the focus on David. He tells a story of another time that he was caught in the cave of Adullam. All right, so he's in the cave, but instead of hiding from Saul this time he's hiding from the Philistines who are making a military advance in the land of Judah. And they have even taken over the land or the city of Bethlehem, which is where David is from. And so David is in the cave and he's casually lamenting and goes, "Oh, if only I could have a drink from the well in Bethlehem, the town where he grew up in." That's what he laments. And so he's just venting. He wants comforts. He's sick of living in a cave. He wants some comforts. But the men hear this, and so three of the mighty men sneak out of the cave, sneak into Bethlehem, sneak past the Philistine garrison, get water to bring back to David. Now that shows the incredible courage those men had. That shows the incredible love that they have for David, that they were willing to risk their lives for that. But David is also confronted with a decision there. Does he drink it? Does he drink this water? Because to drink it is to acknowledge that his life is more important than theirs. That having his thirst quenched, his comfort of drinking from his well is more important than their blood, their lives. And so David, when he's confronted with that choice, decides to pour out that drink, that far be it from him to risk their lives for his own gain. And so that's what we see with David. This is a king that does not use people for his own gain. And while that was mainly true of David, it wasn't always true of David. See, because the last name mentioned in the list of mighty men in 2 Samuel is the name Uriah the Hittite. I mean, to end that list with that name. The reason why it's so shocking is because that was David's greatest failure. Uriah is one of his mighty men. He was serving in his military, you know, fighting, risking his life for David and his army. When David is back in Jerusalem, David sees his Uriah's wife, Bathsheba, decides to take her, sleeps with her. She gets pregnant. And David doesn't want a scandal on his hand. So he decides to have Uriah sent back from battle in order and sends him home in order to sleep with his wife, and then the secret would be covered and everything would be hush-hush, right? But the problem is that Uriah doesn't feel right taking the comforts of home when his fellow soldiers are fighting and sleeping on the earth and risking their lives. And so he doesn't feel right indulging in the comforts. And so he doesn't do it. And so David sends orders with him to hand to his commander that Uriah goes back to the battle. And when Uriah's there, the orders were to have Uriah put at the front line and then to have the rest of the men back off. And he essentially orders Uriah's murder. That's what David did. And so the fact that the list ends with this name, it's a big red check mark. Because how can men rally to a king like David when he might take their wives or kill them? And that's why we need a better king than even David was. And that's why the rest of the Old Testament shifts to look for the descendant of David who will be the one to truly establish God's rule on earth. And when we arrive to the New Testament, Jesus is presented to us as the Son of David. Whereas David ordered the death of one of his mighty men in order to satisfy his own desires and protect his own status, Jesus, on the other hand, was willing to be mocked, beaten, and killed in order to work for our good. Now, think for a minute of how much David's men loved him and we're willing to risk to serve him. How much more should we love great David's greater son, Jesus? How much more should we be willing to risk to serve him and his kingdom? See, 1 and 2 Samuel focus so much on David. He's one of those people you feel like you get to know the most when you read through the Old Testament. But this list reminds us that David's kingdom wasn't a solo project. It was built through the faithful love and service of men like these. And even the church today is not a solo project. It's not celebrity pastors. It's not individuals. The church is built today through everyday people, through the faithful love and service of all kinds of men and women. And the men in David's days, these mighty men, they weren't the great men of the day. They were, in some ways, the nobodies. They were debtors, foreigners, discontents. But these were the men whom God used to build David's kingdom. And notice that is the reality. It's that they're nobodies that God used. That God didn't need people who have it all together. He could use these nobodies to accomplish incredibly heroic acts. And that's why even the author of 2 Samuel is drawing our attention to that. When he describes Eleazar, he says it this way. He rose and struck down the Philistines until his hand was weary and his hand clung to the sword. And the Lord brought about a great victory that day. And the men returned after him only to strip the slain. Or of Shammah, another mighty man, in 2 Samuel 23:12. But he took his stand in the midst of the plot and defended it and struck down the Philistines. And the Lord worked a great victory. See, it's God who ultimately used the risk that these men took to bring about a great victory. And Jesus established his kingdom in the New Testament through fishermen, tax collectors, failed revolutionaries, people regarded as uneducated and unimportant. But the people that rallied to him are the ones that he used to build his kingdom that spread throughout the whole earth. So we all have choices to make about what we want to live for. Do we want to live just for ourselves and live our small status quo life that will just fit in and blend in America here in Columbia, Missouri? Or do we want to take a step to live for something bigger than our own lives? See, God wants to build his kingdom through us today. He's not looking for simply pastors. He doesn't need celebrities to be the ones who get the word out. We don't have to have it all together. We don't have to pass a Bible knowledge quiz. We just have to be people who come to Jesus and ask him to use us. We don't have to go overseas to advance God's kingdom. We don't have to join a monastery or a nunnery. We just have to ask, what does it look like for me to live for God's purposes where I am at this phase of my life? See, Jim Weisbrook, a member here at The Crossing, asked himself what he could do now that he was retired. And let's listen to his story.
You know, I never viewed retirement as stopping working. I always like to keep busy. I think that we're supposed to work and we're supposed to enjoy it. It's kind of my hobby now. This and other things that I do, but yeah, primarily this. I enjoy taking something broken and making it work again. It just started out by trying to provide a way for people to make a living in countries where it's hard to make a living. And sewing machines and sewing is one way that people can do that. They can either provide their own clothing or make things that they can then sell and make a living doing that. It's interesting because every once in a while I'll be working on a machine. I think about the pictures of the people and who's actually going to be using this machine. It's kind of weird because you don't know what the person who receives this, what they're going to do with it, what they're going to make with it. But it's kind of cool. We have a tendency to just think about ourselves all the time. So this is a way that helps me to stay focused on something other than myself. And I think if I were retired and just played golf and had fun, it's all me focused. And you know, I don't want to be me focused. I want to look out and see the broader picture of God being involved in the world.
Like Jim said, he could have used his retirement in all different kinds of ways. To indulge himself, to live for himself, to finally take his time to care for himself. But instead, he asked, God, what do you want me to do? How can I be of use to people? So he does a small thing. And yet God is using it in big ways to be a blessing to other people. Where does God have you right now? If you're a college student, you have opportunities now at this phase of your life to be around all kinds of people that you're not going to have later in life. What does it look like for you to represent Christ well during this time? If you're an empty nester, how can you use this time now that you have in your life to advance God's kingdom in ways that you couldn't before? How can we use our time, our resources, in better ways to advance God's kingdom? How can we better live for God's purposes at our workplaces, in our neighborhoods, or even under our own roof? And trying to think through all these areas might feel overwhelming, but what's one step in one area that we could take to better live for God's purposes? It may not even feel like something that big or significant, but God often uses small things to advance his kingdom in significant ways. See, this random list of David's mighty men is a reminder to us this morning that God can use nobodies to build his kingdom. Do we want to be listed among men like these, men who made great risks to build the kingdom that God was building? So please stand as we continue our worship. As we sing this song, this is a chance for us to renew our desire to live for his kingdom, even though we're admitting our struggle and our fears that we have in our heart. But we worship a God who graciously uses even weak-hearted people who come back to him to be a part of the great works that he is doing in the world. So let's worship this God.